Excellent. All the music this morning that Nathan has prepared come from the pens of gay composers, Poulenc and so forth. The text that Sue Ann sung is by W. H. Auden, also a gay man. And it's all in support of the theme of my sermon this morning. But as usual, before I give my sermon, there are two readings, and the two readings are so diverse and different from each other that, once again, I'm playing a game and trying to throw you off the scent to figure out where I'm going to go. So, here's the reading that will throw you off the scent. It's found in the New Testament, part of a continuation of the book of Luke, which has been attributed to a man named Lukas since around the second century. We actually don't know who wrote it. Called The Activities of the Envoys, in modern translation, it is traditionally known as the Acts of the Apostles. Philip was traveling on the desert road to Gaza. He was well on his way when he came within sight of the horse cart of a man from Ethiopia. This man was a eunuch and a high official in the court of the Kandake, or queen of Ethiopia, her treasurer, in fact. He had come to Jerusalem to worship, but was now returning home. He was sitting in his cart, reading a scroll. It was the scroll of Isaiah. Philip caught up with the eunuch and overheard him reading the words of the prophet aloud. "Do you comprehend what you're reading?" asked Philip. "How can I understand what this means unless I get some help?" answered the eunuch. He invited Philip to join him in the cart and sit beside him. Here was the passage he was reading. "He was silent, like a sheep led to the slaughterhouse, or a lamb before the shearer. His shaming was done by others, by which we know him to be innocent. Who will tell his family? For his life has been cut off from the earth." So the eunuch said to Philip, "Who is this about? The prophet or someone else?" So then Philip brought good news to the eunuch and spoke to him of the teachings of Jesus. After a while, they came to a place with running water. The eunuch asked, "Any reason why I should not immerse myself in the water and start a new life?" Both of them stepped into the water, and Philip immersed him into it, a sign of a transformed life. After this, the eunuch returned home with a new sense of joy, and Philip continued to preach in the towns thereabout until he reached Caesarea. The second reading comes from a most remarkable book, which I recommend to those who are interested in the subject. It's called Gay Life and Culture, A World History. And for the first time, the person using the word world history actually means it. You know, she talks about Melanesia, Australia, New Zealand, the world, the whole world, Africa, every place. It was written in 2006. These words come from an essay in that book by Layla Rupp called Loving Women in the Modern World.
Toward the end of her life, Anne Lister obtained her wish to marry a woman. She courted Anne Walker, a neighbor. At first, Walker described their relationship as good as a marriage. Later, they exchanged rings, moved in together, and rewrote their wills. Although Lister was considered odd in her community, she also held economic and social power. Despite gossip, the two women lived together without censure. The story of the emergence of lesbian identity has geographic limitations, but the notion of love, and sexual desire or activities has more fluid boundaries. That is, the term lesbian has a relatively recent origin in Western culture. But there were other words women applied to themselves to describe their desires and actions. Before the invention of the word homosexuality in 1869, Ann Lister saw her love for women as a defining characteristic. She knew the term sapphic and considered her attraction to women natural, and proclaimed proudly, "I love and only love the fairer sex."
Just in case you want to educate yourself about a wide variety of things having to do with the subject, look at the cover of your order of celebration. The triangle is a symbol of GLBT people. It has been since the time of the Shoah, when the Nazis, as well as killing Jews and Gypsies, the Roma people, trade unionists, whatever, also killed many homosexual people. There's a list of people who were gay or bisexual or transgender or lesbian. There's also a list of words that have to do with groups of people. And so, you know, the computer is a great little tool these days. You can plug in any of these words and find out something new almost every day. Well, summer is almost here. A few more thunderstorms, perhaps, and then we'll settle in for some longer spans of ridiculously humid heat with fireflies flashing over the grass like dancing constellations. School is out now. We've packed away the graduation gowns and sent out the thank you notes. We've unfolded crinkly maps to plan possible trips. Weddings planned a year ago come now to fruition. And teachers, students, and I assure you, ministers, feel a bit of relief as spring sinks into the mud with the rain and summer sweeps in a flash of lightning. It's also festival season. Summer is. The Asian and the arts festivals, jazz and the Topiary Park, Confest, and perhaps for some the most festival of all, the Pride Parade, a celebration of the diversity of the local gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and questioning or queer communities. A mouthful, I know, but fair. Even that word queer, which was an insult just a few decades ago, certainly in my memory, has been claimed by some of the younger generation as a more appropriate word than either gay, lesbian, or bisexual. But I understand that language change is pretty tough. I remember when the rabbi at the synagogue I used to support used that word queer to describe her bisexual self, and many of the elders in her community crossed their arms in restrained rage for months. How dare she use a word that ruined my school days? But it's hardly the first time that words about sexual minorities in the world have changed, been lost, or created anew. In ancient times, there were no words that translated into the modern words gay, lesbian, or even homosexual. So all of the religious conservatives that insist on using those words in English translations of their Bibles are simply lying through their teeth, a deed that simply infuriates me. No, there were no clear synonyms in any ancient language to our modern words for gay and lesbian, but that does not mean that sexual minorities are something new. The ancients, you see, just didn't label their relationships with tidy words. They described them. We know, for example, that Julius Caesar got around having a sexual relationship with Nicomedes of Bithynia as a young man, and then engaging with several women, including, famously, Cleopatra, during his middle age. His life was ridiculed all over Rome with crude graffiti scribbled on the walls. A husband to every woman and a wife to every man. But he was never called bisexual. The word had not been invented yet, nor the concept. Nor did he let ridicule about his sexual life stop him from being a populist, bestowing citizenship on Roman and on immigrants to Rome freely, and working to redistribute land on behalf of the poor. Yes, he was something of an opportunist. Sadly, my experience has taught me that most of us are at some time or another. But despite that, Caesar never seems to have cowered before public opinion about his sexual life. Ann Lister, whom you heard about in the second reading by Leila Rupp, claimed a number of relationships with women, and only women, she confirms, but she did not have the word lesbian to claim. It wasn't in use yet. But her love for Ann Walker was real. Their relationship, an exchange of rings, was real. Their actions were perfectly in line with the realities of marriage, even though neither church nor state was involved. Rupp tells us that Lister did know the word sapphic, however, and that's a word we no longer use. It's taken from the name of the great poet of ancient Greece, Sappho of Lesbos, the island Lesbos. As you know, we don't refer to the Greek poet anymore, just to the island of her birth, when we say the word lesbian. What's important is that Rupp, in speaking of Ann Lister, writes, she proclaimed proudly, I love and only love the fairer sex. In other words, she simply wasn't ashamed to be who she was. She was proud to be who she was, Ann Lister. She didn't have a particular word to describe herself and her love, but she did indeed have her life, and she had her love, and she had her pride, and she had her identity. When Jehan Tarc of Domremy in France, the French militarist whom we strangely know as Joan of Arc, was alive, the word transgender certainly did not exist in any form, neither did the word transvestite. And yet it's plain that her fearsome death sentence, to be burned at the stake, was only carried out when she deliberately, once again, put on men's clothes. This despite the sure threat of being burned to the stake for doing so. She refused to be told she didn't know how to live her life. Call her foolish if you want for risking death, and such a death. But she had a fierce pride inside of her, and I compliment her for that. When Italian Renaissance architect, painter, sculptor, and poet Michelangelo Buonarroti wrote all of his sumptuous love sonnets to Tommaso Cavaliere, or gushed with his sexual desire for Febo di Poggio, there was no word gay, no word homosexual, not even the word queer that he could use. But his same-sex desire is without question. He sometimes even joked about his inclination. You might say that he was proud to be himself, not just as a remarkable artist, but as a man of desire. Now look, just as being proud doesn't mean he was arrogant, it also doesn't mean he was entirely comfortable with his desire either, and he wasn't. He wrestled painfully with his powerful feelings for other men all of his life. After all, the church for which he had been working over the decades had a rather disturbing habit in those days. It did one of two things. Either it crowned a same-sex loving bishop of Rome like Pope Julius III, who used to have way fun in the Vatican, or they burned same-sex loving friars at the stake in the piazzas of Rome, condemning them with a word we also don't use anymore, sodomite. In such a world of unpredictable, cruel, and totalitarian religious craziness, the artist could hardly have been untormented. He was known back then by his peers and by the people as Il Terribilità, the terrible one, because of his refusal to kowtow to anyone at all, including the Pope. But his poetry reveals a more fearful man, browbeaten by church teachings. Yet he not only thrived despite the torment, but he completed the two Sistine paintings, designed three magnificent buildings and saw them built, and completed dozens of sculptures still revered by millions, and he is considered, after Dante, the greatest poet of Italy. It takes healthy pride and belief in oneself to do all that, I would have to say. Friars burned at the stake in Rome for engaging in love with members of the same gender were indeed called sodomites after the famous biblical story. A story, mind you, which no one had ever understood in a sexual way until 1,000 years after the story was first written. Now, 1,500 years after that, even well-educated people can't read that story and not think of sexuality. And because of that, many teens who see themselves as parts of sexual minorities are still tormented, just as much as Michelangelo was, because of the religious totalitarianism of their upbringing. Yes, I know that for many of the younger generation, sexual orientation is no big deal anymore. I know that. But that is only true usually, not always, but usually, for those who have consciously decided not to let unquestioned religious or political posturing dominate their lives. As I have often said in this pulpit, the Bible is not a book. It's a library of many, many books. And anyone who uses the phrase, "the Bible says," is simply not telling the truth. The Bible doesn't say a damn thing. It just sits there, dozens and dozens of books from ancient times, by as much as 100 different authors writing at different times for different reasons, saying contradictory different things. There are so many contradictory opinions and stories in it, some wonderful, some awful, that no singular message can be taken from it except by those minds who thrive in the totalitarian mindset and want to control you, me, and every young mind of whatever sexual orientation. And to quote the Book of Common Prayer, there is no health in that. But just because some folks use a bigotry-based take on the Bible as a club to hurt others does not mean the book cannot also be used well by anyone concerned for the welfare of others, especially sexual minorities struggling with shame or lack of pride. Take the story of the Ethiopian eunuch, for example. Let me now climb into your horse cart, sit next to you, and help you to find the wisdom in this scripture. First, the author of the story takes great pains to let us know certain things. The main character is called a eunuch, a name for a sexual minority at that time. Because of the power, and it's very powerful, we all know that, the power of sexuality in human lives, some men in ancient times, not by their own will usually, were surgically altered to allow them to work safely with women. Horrible idea, I know, but it was a common practice. And large numbers of eunuchs cared for the needs of harems, things like that, and also served as officials in the government. Without being married, they had more time to serve. The Kandake of Ethiopia, the queen, however, employed her eunuch as the treasurer, a post requiring great skill and obviously great trust. Now, in the biblical story, this treasurer had gone to Jerusalem to worship, from which he presumably had been turned away, since eunuchs were not allowed to worship in the temple. Philip, one of the Greek-speaking students of Jesus, encountered this man as he was riding home through the desert in his horse-drawn cart. The author tells us the eunuch is reading a scroll. This is remarkable for several reasons. One, because only a small percentage of the population of the ancient world could read at all. And two, to possess a scroll meant that you were very well off. Books then were like gold. The author then tells us that the book is the book of Isaiah, one of the Hebrew prophets. And then he quotes it. This tells us two things. One, even though he may have been excluded from worship, he had not given up on the spiritual life. He was still reading. Two, by giving us the quote, the author is following the usual practice of all ancient authors by treating the small quote as an invitation to read the larger passages that follow after it. And what do you find when you turn to the book of Isaiah and find that quote and then read right after it? Wouldn't you know it? A passage about eunuchs. A passage that says that although another book in the Bible warns both eunuchs and foreigners to stay away from community worship, that passage no longer applies. Instead, Isaiah tells eunuchs and the sexual minorities of his day and all strangers, come to worship. You're welcome here. You can still practice your religion. In fact, you yourselves will be revered in my temple as sons and daughters. Nor does the quoted Isaiah passage refer to Jesus any more than the passage about Sodom refers to sexuality. He was silent like a sheep led to the slaughterhouse or a lamb before the shearer. His shaming was done by others, by which we know him to be innocent. Who will tell his family where his life is cut off from the earth? That last line confirms that this is not about Jesus. No New Testament author would say that he was cut off from the earth and stopped there without proclaiming some form of resurrection. Instead, the passage refers to sexual minorities and foreigners, strangers, like the Ethiopian, who have been harassed all of their lives about being religious, told they do not belong in religious community, nor are they worthy of a spiritual life. They may be given jobs, and they may be trusted, but they're not seen as entirely human. They have been shamed by others, told they are barren fruit trees, useless, and indeed cut off from the earth. After all, Matthew Shepherd and Roman friars are hardly the only ones to actually be killed in history for who they were. The Ethiopian is glad that he's got a good job, mind you, but he still wants a full life of welcome, not exclusion. He wants a life of pride, not shame. The story says that upon hearing the good news that Jesus welcomed all people no matter who they were, and that's the only gospel there is, his death has nothing to do with anything. He wants to be immersed, to change his life. And that immersion is a symbol that we no longer practice. But you know, it's not the symbol that's important. It's the new life that's important. The right to be proud of who you are, to love who you are, to not be shamed about being who you are, is what's important. The right to live, to thrive, to be a full part of the human family in every way, in all of our diverse uniqueness, that's what's important. You can symbolize it any way you want. The annual Pride Parade here in Columbus is just a symbol, too. A symbol of rejoicing, a symbol of play, a symbol of joy, and a sign of new life for many. An immersion, if you will, not into a watery stream in the desert, but into the stream of new life itself, the clean, clear current of pride that flows safely through the desert of shame, ridicule, and the desire for totalitarian control. It's summer. Lots of festivals, lots of fun. But no matter the season, summer or fall or winter or spring, it's always time to be as proud as Molly Lou Mellon in our story this morning, and to believe in ourselves.